Hi, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Core Intuition, featuring two traveling Luddites talking about Mac development. Welcome to the second episode, and thank you everyone for listening last time and for sending in comments.
Thanks a lot, everybody. Yeah, it's been great to get the positive feedback. There have been a couple pieces of helpful advice about certain things, but I think the overall impression is that we are doing a decent job of getting some content out there that you enjoy listening to.
So Daniel, last time after we recorded, you actually went on vacation to the UK. How was it?
Oh, it was great. It was sort of a 1 year anniversary trip for me. Me and my wife just sort of decided to jet over to jolly England. We went to Oxford, and it was great. We got to meet some Mac people in the UK. Scotty from the Mac Developer Network.
Great.
Came down, and Mike Abdullah from Carelia, and Graham Lee, who's working at a company over there called Sophos. My wife and I had some just tourist stuff to do and wandering around, exploring the villages around Oxford. And then we had a little night of geeking out with the Mac nerds. So that was fun.
And did you take your laptop and work, or were you trying to really disconnect from everything?
I tend to always take my laptop with me these days, just as a sort of an emergency precaution, and because, more and more I find as the web is available, even if you are doing something sort of totally off work and trying to relax, I really think having access to the internet is becoming such an aid to exploring another country or another town in your own country. So I try to make sure I'm always connected when possible, and as the go-to guy for support at Red Sweater, I still sort of keep an eye on the support and handle as much of that as I can while I'm on the road.
Yeah, I find actually I relax more on vacation sometimes when I am a little bit connected.
Yeah,
because I don't worry that something bad has happened.
Right.
I don't need to be tied to email all day, but if I just check in at least a few times, then I'm confident that nothing is blown up or no one's angry or whatever.
Right. It definitely feels good when you can, especially if you can get down to on vacation and you know that you've just checked your support and there's absolutely nothing pending and nothing, mm-hmm. Nothing gnawing at you. I agree. It really does make it more relaxing than just guessing. I also have a little system, I have it set up so I can do the Apple remote log into my Mac at home.
Mm-hmm.
And
cool.
I'm a paranoid person by nature, so I sort of enjoy doing that. And every time I do it, I reassure myself, well, if I'm logged in, then nobody broke into my house and stole my computer.
Do you fire up a photo booth and look out the eyesight and see what's
No.
What's
it would be cool to leave one of those and a monitor somewhere where we have two cats, and it would be kind of cool if we could try to get their attention from afar.
You can have your Mac speak things and...
Yeah, yeah, right. We could practically, probably they practically wouldn't know the difference between us actually being there, except for the, no warm arm to cuddle up against.
That's cool. I actually, the back to my Mac stuff is working well for me now. I know a lot of people were complaining about it, and I did too until I got a time capsule and replaced my old base station, and it works really well.
Oh, really?
So
okay.
I've been really happy with just... being in a coffee shop or, somewhere and just be able to connect back to my Mac Pro and just, I tend not to have email on both machines unless I'm traveling for an extended period of time.
I have a fear of running two email clients at the same time, I think, because sometimes they get out of whack with each other. So for this trip, for instance, I did rely on the remote desktop into my mail at home. And it's a little annoying, but I don't really know of a more 100% reliable solution. I have toyed with trying to run two clients, and it seems to work most of the time, but I'm a little afraid of it.
I'm sort of a newcomer to IMAP. I know that sounds silly, but I stayed with POP for years and years and years, basically until the iPhone came and forced, the only way to do email on the iPhone is you have to have IMAP. That's the only reasonable way to do it, but I'm still sort of stuck in that old age of POP and not dealing with multiple machines, syncing red message, red states and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I understand completely. I've been on IMAP for a while, but I have a perhaps overly intricate filing system that moves stuff off of the IMAP and
right.
into local, permanent folders. And I sometimes fear that if I'm checking from another computer, I might be grabbing the message before my main mail program gets a chance to do its thing with it.
Mm-hmm. The traveling thing is interesting. I've actually changed since I've got the iPhone. I've changed a little bit how I do things. And last year, actually, I went just to the beach for a few days, and I didn't take my laptop. I actually just took the iPhone, and that was a really interesting experiment. So overall successful. Like, I was able to check my email, respond to simple things. The only problem I ran into was for support email that wasn't that required a little more involved response.
Right.
I guess, like, for example, if someone loses their serial number, they can just go online and they enter their email address and it automatically sends it to them. I don't need to be involved in that. But if their email address is changed and they need to look it up or something that the automated system doesn't handle, that was really tricky to do. And I had a couple cases like that while I was going iPhone only, where I had to actually look up their serial number and like write it on a napkin and then email it to the, and then make a new message and like write it in again,
right.
because there's no copy and paste.
The power of iPhone. You won't see that featured in an Apple commercial. There's never been a iPod that would make you write things on a napkin.
it was, I felt silly doing it, but and it did take way longer. Luckily, my serial numbers are very short. They're only, I think 12 characters long anyway, so it didn't take forever, but it was painful. And maybe that's a third-party opportunity. Obviously, copy and paste needs to be there eventually, but maybe I need to write. My first iPhone app is just something
there you
helps
go.
Me do support.
Yeah, your portable support station. That sounds good. It could be set up to sort of do some of the common queries or whatever that you need to do mm-hmm. on your home base.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I've been tempted to I have an iPod Touch. I'm probably going to get one of these rumored new iPhones if they come out next week. I have been tempted to sort of forego the laptop and switch to the mobile Safari and mobile mail. But it's so far, I guess I haven't been challenged with enough of a reason to do it, and so I haven't wanted to give up the luxury of a keyboard and a big screen.
Right.
So I mean, as great as the browser on the iPhone is, it's still, to me, obviously somewhat frustrating to use compared to a desktop computer.
Did you use the Touch when you were in the UK at all for maps or things like that when you were on Wi-Fi?
I didn't. I haven't really gotten into the groove of using the Touch on the run, and I think it's partly because I think I'm running into exactly that limitation of relying only on Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas people with the cell phone network support, they will get into the groove of knowing more or less that they'll have coverage and that they'll have access. I tried to use the Touch once in New York City, and it was fairly successful just because I could roam a little bit and find an open Wi-Fi network. But it wasn't quite successful enough because of the lack of a reliable network.
The case I was talking about last summer, there was no Wi-Fi at all, where we were, and so it was nice to know the edge was there, and even if it was slow and painful, I could take 20 minutes and deal with things. But yeah, the last couple conferences I've been to, like C4 last year and South by Southwest a few months ago, I did the whole leave the laptop in the hotel room thing, and that worked really well. But I don't know if that's really possible at WWDC because there's so many hands-on sessions and labs, and maybe you want to show your software to somebody. I just don't know how realistic that is. I may try it like the first day.
I agree. It would be great for a conference like WWDC because I tend to go down to the conference, hang out, go to sessions, go to lunch, go to more sessions. And then, whatever evening events, it's easier for people who are staying down by the convention center. I have sort of the luxury of staying with some friends who live a little further away. And so I'm usually stuck with whatever I bring down, until the end of the day. So last year I found myself just going completely solo without a computer or anything.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a drag during the day, but when I was out in the evening, it was a real liberation to just be, you know, with myself and my jacket and mm-hmm. and not having to worry about something getting stolen. So one of the things that's particularly good news to COCO programmers or aspiring COCO programmers, the COCO programming book by Aaron Hillegass, its new edition, I think, has just come out last week or something. Does that sound right?
Yeah, just at least just a couple weeks ago, maybe. I ordered my copy and it showed up last week,
I guess. Oh, cool. So you've already got it in your hands, and what do you think?
I do. I like it. I wanted to order this one because I don't actually own the first two editions. Right. I read them at, you know, I borrowed from someone or read them in the bookstore. Even though for, you know, experienced COCO programmers, most of the book is review, I kind of wanted to be re-inspired to use some technologies that I don't fully, maybe I don't respect enough, particularly like bindings. I've been really bad about not embracing fully. And so I thought maybe, you know, get a fresh look on some topics and see if it would, you know, kickstart me to use certain things.
Yeah, I think that's it can always be a good idea to review, you know, even an introductory book. I have an older edition. I haven't purchased this new edition. I guess I sort of have reached the point of COCO programming where I feel perhaps wrongly too confident with my ability to figure things out on my own. Or what you say is true, that sometimes just getting a new introduction to one of the technologies you haven't spent too much time with is worth an entire book itself. I'm with you on the bindings thing, and on a lot of things. I'm sort of a learn about it but don't use it type of person.
Yeah, I was kind of jaded, I guess, at the beginning. At the time when like key value coding and observing and then bindings came out, I was still supporting like 10.2 and earlier, and I couldn't use it, so I sort of sat through the WWDC sessions and then sort of ignored it. And then when I was requiring 10.4, so I went and I would use, you know, some of these things. I don't know, I never felt like it really clicked. Especially bindings has always been kind of frustrating for me because I don't feel like it's very readable when you hook things up in IB. And it's, you know, it saves a few lines of code here or there, but then at the end, like 6 months later, when you're trying to decipher what you've done, yeah, I'm not sure it really helps. So I was hoping that this book would sort of inspire me to love it more than I do.
Well, you know, I think it's one of those things where you save a lot of time sometimes by embracing the new technology. But on the other side of that coin, especially right now in the context of the iPhone, look what my technology Ludditism has bought me. For instance, I don't use Core Data, and I use bindings fairly minimally. Mm-hmm. Lo and behold, you get the iPhone comes out, and you know, a lot of the newer technologies that Apple has been developing, such as Core Animation, well, they are on the iPhone, so it's great if you've embraced those. But then other technologies, developers are running into the obstacles of having to figure out how to sort of replace wholesale their segments of their apps that don't have counterparts on the iPhone. It's sort of backwards thinking, but I sort of feel excited in some ways that I didn't overly embrace some of the technologies that would have probably made my code more, you know, streamlined and healthy, but would have also left me less portable.
Yeah, and I think in general with technologies, it's good to have the foundation, sort of the old way of doing things, before you jump up to the higher level abstraction or whatever. I've been doing SQLite stuff for years, and I still haven't really jumped onto Core Data except to experiment with. And like you said, you know, now on the iPhone, that experience pays off because you can just translate what you've done over without worrying that you've got to relearn sort of the hard way to do things.
Right.
Yeah, and so for people who aren't familiar with the book, everything new in Leopard is covered well. Screenshots, if you're just getting started with COCO, you're not going to be confused that the screenshots are in, you know, IB2 and you're using 3. Definitely Core Data, you know, Core Animation. There's chapters on basically every major new feature, you know, garbage collection. I was glad to see that he doesn't say, like at the beginning, you know, garbage collection's great, use that. We're not going to bother showing you, you know, the traditional way to do reference counting and
That's good. Yeah, I think it's, I agree with you that it's good to know the fundamentals so you know what the system is doing for you. And also, yeah, as we were saying, there's no garbage collection on the iPhone, so I wonder if that was an NDA violation.
Whoops. Do you buy tech books much anymore? I was actually kind of surprised a little bit that I bought this. I tend not to anymore. I tend to just go online or look in the Xcode reference for whatever I need.
I found myself over the past few years, since my job role has taken on so many new responsibilities, sort of needing to take responsibility for marketing type things in the company and that sort of higher level design issues about how applications should be designed, the interfaces and such. I find my book collection is sort of growing in the areas of business advice and interface design, interaction design, because I find these types of books very sort of inspiring when you just pick it up to read maybe just a chapter here and there. And they're the types of books that, you don't keep them for factual reference. You sort of just keep them for inspirational reference, I think.
Yeah, and another nice thing about some of those books is they don't grow stale quite as quickly. You know, if it's a book on business advice or user interface design, you could keep that book for 10 years and it probably still be relevant.
Right.
To some extent. But most books on, what's new in Leopard, I mean, that's, you're not going to be able to keep that book very long before it's useless. And I a couple years ago, I purged all, dozens of old, Inside Macs and tech books that they just weren't relevant. I mean, the only reason I kept them was because I remember that time kind of fondly.
Right.
There was no practical use to keep them anymore.
Yeah, I've gone through those phases of, of disposing old tech books and looking again at my bookshelf, a couple that I recently went through and tried to get rid of some stuff, and a couple that I can't seem to get rid of are the 68,000 processor manual and
awesome.
and the PowerPC instruction reference.
Nice.
And I think I Twittered about this, and people were quick to point out how easily accessible these references are on the web.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really true, and it's so not the point, because I have not referenced those books in years now, but they do sort of remind me of a time, they're sort of souvenirs for past lives.
So Daniel, you were twittering last week, I guess, about source control and Git. Have you been diving into that lately?
I did dive into it a little bit. I've sort of been diving into that gradually over the past, maybe the past year. I don't know, when did this recent sort of episode of resurging interest in Git and distributed source control start coming up? But I have been going through all the stages of
denial,
shock, denial, yeah, shock, denial, acceptance. I think maybe just sort of through osmosis, listening to people talk about the various solutions that they've discovered, I have come to appreciate some of the advantages that a distributed system would offer me. Maybe I'll explain just briefly, the differences between a distributed system and a non-distributed system, in case listeners are curious and don't know. Basically, a source control system, it allows you to take your documents, your source files, whatever you're working on, and version them so that you can go back to a previous edition if you make a mistake or if you need to go back and look at how you did something in the past. So traditionally, the way this has worked is a source control system has a repository, which is sort of like the library of all of your past revisions. Typically, that's just this one well-known place. Maybe your workplace has a server running this repository. And a sort of change on that idea is, instead of having this one repository with all the changes that people are making, everybody sort of makes a copy of the whole repository so they can do their work independently and make changes and check in changes, make revisions. And then when they're confident that the stuff they've been working on is good enough to share with their teammates or with the rest of the world, they then sort of merge their entire tree back in with the main tree. I don't know if that was a, I don't know if that was a, an effective description, but
yeah, that was good.
Basically, what's driving me towards thinking about these distributed systems is a few things, but one of the really awesome aspects of this setup is you end up with a flexibility of working on your versioned documents offline. So it's something that I can relate to. You know, my, my product Mars Edit is sort of a blogging tool for working offline, among other things. But the idea is then if I'm on a plane or if I'm in a hotel that doesn't have wireless, or if I'm at the park, say, if I wanted to go work at the park, then I might like to be able to do some experiments on my source code and see how things are working, make some changes. Instead of having to wait until I get home to check those changes in, with a distributed system, I can check those changes in on my own computer in the park, let's say, and then work some more and make some more changes and check those in. And you keep the granularity of all of these revisions. And then when I get home, I can... theoretically, I haven't switched to this system yet, but the idea is then when I get home, I can sort of merge all of those changes back into my main source repository. And I just find that very liberating, the idea that I would be able to sort of maintain all the advantages of version control regardless of whether I'm connected to the network.
That is compelling. The sort of two gripes I think I have with Subversion, which until recently I thought were fairly minor gripes, are what you said, you know, you can't work offline and be able to branch or commit or deal with your changes at that level. And then like the .svn folders, very annoying, especially in the Mac OS X environment and with old nibs and file packages, which will then contain .svn folders and you can't easily copy them around without taking part of Subversion with you and it being real frustrating. Those two things were the big things, and I thought I could just live with those for another couple of years because I was really slow to leave CVS for Subversion, and that the problems with CVS were way worse than Subversion. You know, you couldn't easily rename files, right. For example.
I remember. Yes.
So I don't mean to bring that up. I don't want to relive any painful memories.
You're giving me nightmares.
But so Subversion, I thought I could wait a while for them to take care of at least the .svn thing, because that's extremely frustrating.
Yeah, I went through the experience of feeling sort of allegiant to Subversion.
Right.
And then at one point, one day, it just sort of lifted. And I think what it is going back to CVS, I did the same transition where I came from CVS to Subversion. And the improvements were so great, I think it sort of made me loyal to Subversion to some extent without question or without reason. After a certain point, I was sort of so in love with what Subversion had done for me that it was I was hesitant to learn something new, and I think I was really confident in Subversion, and before I learned in more detail some of the things I was missing. And am missing, I think I just expected, you know, after having such a great experience with Subversion, I think I probably expected that surely all of these advantages were just around the corner for Subversion. Or, you know, perhaps I was underestimating how much really hard work it is to, you know, merge these ideas into an existing product like Subversion.
Yeah, and it's also, with the allegiance, it's not just that, but there's so much friction with moving to another system. It's common to talk to developers, and they're gonna blow at least a couple days, maybe a week, moving some projects over when you deal with the whole thing of changing the server and then any commit scripts you have or integration with bug tracking software or whatever you've got. It's gonna take a while, and so I usually look at that as, well, the gains they're good, but I could spend that week writing real code that benefits users. So that's kind of frustrating too.
Yeah, so to the sort of contenders' credit, the ones I've tried out so far on some level are Git, G-I-T, which is very popular, and another one called Mercurial. Its command line tool's name is HG. Both of these tools, I tested them out on my existing Subversion repositories, and I took one of my simpler repositories, but I was impressed that they both come with specifically for Subversion, command line tools that will sort of go in and import your Subversion history. And they were smart enough to do things like detect a trunk folder, detect tags and branches folders in Subversion, and then translate those into the appropriate native branches and tags in the new system. I'm not that afraid of the friction of switching, although you're right that even in the best scenario, it's still going to take a couple days or so just to get everything ironed out.
Yeah, I felt a lot better when I saw the Subversion integration. I've only tried Git so far. I definitely went into it sort of resistant to change until I saw that and realized that you can just pull down a Subversion, you know, basically clone your Subversion repository locally, use Git all you want, branch, merge, commit, do whatever, and then push the change back. And to Subversion, it's just, oh, you're just committing stuff.
Yes, that's an exciting kind of bridge technology, I guess.
So I may do that. I may just do that for a while, especially if you're working on projects with other people. You don't have to even tell them. I mean, you want to tell them that you're excited about this, but you don't need to change anything. You can work with Git, with a Subversion repository, while other people are just using the normal Subversion tools. So that seems like a nice balance. I don't know how frustrating it gets after a while to... I'm not sure. I haven't used it enough to know if pushing changes to Subversion is that much more difficult than if you had a native Git repository.
Mm-hmm.
I basically did what you did. I picked a small kind of project and pulled it down and did some tests with it and some just test branches and merges, and then just to get a feel for how it worked, but not a big project and not with multiple people or anything.
Yeah.
The other thing Git seems to handle really well is ignoring files seems a lot more seamless than Subversion. Some little things like that I don't feel like there are problems with Subversion that would make me switch, but if some of these other systems handle them more seamlessly, that's just kind of a bonus.
Yeah, one of the things that really draws me to these systems is the promise of much improved branching and merging type of behaviors. And I don't really understand exactly why they're so much better, but I think it has to do with the way that both of these systems work, and I believe another one that's often mentioned called Bazaar.
Mm-hmm.
I think they do a much better job of, for each atomic commit that is made, they make a signature for that commit, and it just sort of feels like there's a very strong sense of understanding how exactly the entire repository has changed with each commit, and going back in time, if you go back in time and there's a branch or something, it's built into the system, so the system understands, you know, what a branch is, and is able then, I think, to just very intelligently understand if you have one, you know, one branch here and another branch there. It sounds like it has built into it more smarts for figuring out exactly what that means and what needs to be transferred to sync the two up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real nightmare in Subversion, because even just trying to sort of keep track of one branch merging with another, you sort of have to keep written down notes about where you last merged them, etc.
I agree, and I think if I use some of these other systems more, I would probably branch more often than I do now.
Right.
I tend to only branch when there's no other choice. I've got to branch because I want to work on something independent of a bug fix release or vice versa. I might do more casual branches with Git or something just because I feel like it.
Yeah, I think I would too. I think that's one of the things that's hard to convey to people like us who are fairly happy with Subversion. It's not what will this make better per se, but it's more like, are there things that we wouldn't even consider doing now that we will start to consider doing when we have a better infrastructure to work with?
So you mentioned three different systems. Do you have a fear about if there's going to be a winner, or if, because with Subversion, you know, everyone uses it now. You don't have to really worry that you're going to talk to a developer who's using something else. I mean, there are developers who use other things, but Subversion is the standard.
That's true.
With Git and these others, I feel like Git has emerged as the leader a little bit.
Right.
And I know recently Ruby on Rails officially switched to it, which I think was a big win. When they did that, It maybe had the opposite effect on me because I've been doing Rails work for a while, since before 1.0, and I've seen this transition that community goes in where they're always on the latest, greatest thing. Mm. And it's sometimes frustrating to keep up because they're constantly deprecating old tools or old frameworks or old techniques. So deployment is the best example that I always gripe about, where when it started, you know, used fast CGI, and then 6 months later, no, use Mongrel to deploy, and then 6 months later, use Mod Rails, and you constantly have to be keeping up with what the community is doing, or you'll be left with projects that are just stale. And you know, the last thing I want to do is switch to another source control system and then do it again in 6 months.
I understand completely, yeah. And it does feel comfortable right now. We're in that sort of phase of Subversion's popularity where you feel like you're probably making the right choice if you're using Subversion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just starting to, you know, this effect of the distributed systems, their appeal is just starting to sort of sink into people like you and I who aren't particularly anxious to change. So I am having a little bit of trouble. It's the luxury of choice here with these three systems that, you know, it would be easy if there was one that was sort of unanimously praised as the front runner. But it, you know, if I pick three people, I seem to get three choices about which one I should go to.
Right.
I am a little bit of a follower when it comes to these things that I don't understand as well. So I am a little more inclined, I think, to go with Git, just because, as you said, it does seem to have a little bit more momentum than the other ones. There's some of the high level distinctions I've learned about so far are that apparently Bazaar, BAZAAR, is exceedingly easy to use. Apparently that's one of its selling points, is that it really simplifies the interface, and that's kind of the exact opposite of what people criticize Git for, which is it has a very sort of elaborate, you know, Unix-like interface. Mercurial is praised for its diffing engine is supposed to be very good, and what else? I'm having trouble thinking of what else distinguishes it from Git, because it seems very similar to Git.
Well, they all the systems share this like awkward name or spelling, it seems like to me.
Right.
You mentioned ease of use. I think that's a big one. You know, how, especially for people who are familiar with Subversion, how easy is it to transition? And I found in my Git testing, it was pretty smooth. I mean, there's some new concepts, but the basic day-to-day commands that you use are basically the same. I actually, I watched the Peepcode screencast, which is a nice set of screencasts if people aren't familiar with them. I think they're like $9 each, or you could buy a pack of a certain amount. I think each one's maybe an hour on a subject. And I kind of did a real quick speed watch through it. And it also came with a PDF, which is like just a 1 or 2 page cheat sheet of commands. And if you've used Subversion, you could just look at that little cheat sheet and you're done. I mean, you could basically fumble through and get up to speed with Git in, you know, a few minutes or half an hour or whatever.
Yeah, that's the good thing about Subversion being so popular right now, is it seems all of these systems recognize the need to document what their features are as they relate to Subversion.
Well, thanks everyone for joining us again. And if anyone is at the Worldwide Developer Conference next week and wants to say hi, please look us up.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of our friends out at the conference. And if you can't make it, then you know, pay attention to the Twitter and the blogs. I'm sure you'll be able to get a flavor of what's going on and keep up with what we're all doing out there. We'll hope you hear from us soon.